So this was definitely the most difficult podcast episode I've done so far. And it was also the most personal. But I think because of that, it had to be the one to go first. So I think this episode really encapsulates a lot of what this podcast is about. You know, this podcast is personal. It's about things that are on my mind that interest me, but also it's about having meaningful conversations and reflections with people who are interesting in a deeper way, and people who I can actually connect with and talk to and get very fascinating conversations from. At least I think they're fascinating. So now to Fox. I interviewed Josh Fox in this episode, a documentary filmmaker, and I did this because I watched How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things the Climate Can't Change, or as it's sometimes referred to here, How to Let Go, when I was in fifth grade. And my mom remembers me coming home and saying, "The entire world needs to change. No, like it isn't working anymore. Everything needs to change." And this film really gave me a lot of existential anxiety. I had a lot of anxiety after I watched it in fifth grade, and I still do. I think climate change is so insanely frightening. And climate education and the climate movement has become so ingrained in who I am. I think partially because I learned about climate change so young and because I was terrified by this movie. But recently I've been wondering, what's the price of climate education? Is it worth it? So I went back to the original source of all of my anxiety in life, no, but some of my existential anxiety about climate change, Josh Fox. And I really wanted to ask him that very question.
So I saw that when I was probably about like 10 or 11. And
I remember we were all dancing on stage.
but I honestly it scared me. A lot of my friends and I, well, actually I think mostly me, but it was very terrifying, and I still remember that movie and
Scary movie, it is.
And I still remember that movie to this day. So I have a lot of questions about how much kids should be learning about climate change and at what age and stuff like that. So do you think that children should be learning about climate change from ages 10 or 11?
Yeah, I really think so. I think, well, your teacher is a person who fought really hard against the fracking industry in here in the in Pennsylvania, and she's very bold, She works with, what was it, fourth grade you were in?
I think, yeah, like fourth or
Fourth or
fifth
fifth
grade.
grade? And so, she's the person who knows about that kind of thing. Like I don't know what, age is appropriate for certain things, but I will say that like there's a couple things that I could say. I remember when I was in the fourth grade or fifth grade, the first time that I learned about nuclear war and the atomic bomb. And it scared the shit out of me, and it made me crazy. And I was terrified and really traumatized for a really long time, probably till I was about 16. I lived in utter terror of nuclear war, of the atomic bomb. I mean, this is something that you probably can't process because at the time, it was the Cold War. The United States was, in a battle against Russia all over the world, and we had, tens of thousands of nuclear warheads aimed at each other. And living in New York City, you were in a complete overkill zone. So I had nightmares all the time. Whenever I heard a very loud plane going overhead, it would rattle the buildings, and you would feel like, uh-oh, that's it. It's nuclear war. And I would race to turn on the radio to make sure like everything was normal, And I had dreams, and I would see up in the sky the trails of planes and think, oh no, those are the bombs. And there was a movie called The Day After. And The Day After was a movie about how nuclear war accidentally got set off, and then what happened the day after, and how everybody died. And I refused to let my family or myself watch it. And I went I said, we all have to go out to dinner tonight. And everybody in school watched it, but they were kind of cool with it. Like, they weren't so in on it. Something was different about my reaction to it. And something was different about my reaction in general to these big crises. And I think that, you know, it's a very sensitive person, or it's a person who has an experience with some kind of emotional depth, who at a young age will be able to grasp this, you know? And it sounds like that's what's happening to you. It sounds like you're, can you hear me okay? Because you're stuttering a little bit.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Your video. Okay, just want to make sure. So it sounds like, you know, for me, I think I can't think of my life without that kind of terror that I experienced. And it was really terrifying. And I think that that's what young people are going through right now when they think about climate change, except it's completely the opposite type of time scale, right? Like, nuclear war is a half an hour. And you would, you know, there was these thoughts that, like, you would hear the sirens go or the emergency broadcast system, and you'd have a half an hour left of your life before you were completely obliterated. And in that half an hour, what would you do? And I always thought I would run to the girl's house that I had a crush on and confess that I was in love, and then boom, you would die. You know, these horrible, weird things. For your generation, it's completely the opposite. It seems to be something that's approaching with a degree of inevitability, that it's the entire world spiraling towards this apocalypse. But it takes a long time. It'll take 30 years or 40 years or 50 years. And there's this burden, like, there's no way I, as an individual, I don't think, felt that I could stop a nuclear war. Like, you couldn't stop it. And I think there's a burden placed on people of your generation who understand the severity of the crisis that is on your shoulders. You feel like, I have to get active and do this. I think a lot of people felt that about war in general, nuclear war, when I was growing up. And it instilled in me a sense of, I have to participate in things that are related to social justice. So that terror and that fear, I don't like the fact that I went through that. I don't like the fact that it was a part of my life. It was very hard. And it still is very hard. I still have it, you know, it's still there. Not just of nuclear war, but of this idea that at any minute, life can change in the blink of an eye, you know? And I think that that's what, it's a traumatized thing. So I think it's a traumatizing thing. So I think it's very important that we understand we can't operate when we're traumatized. So we always have to try to heal that trauma. We have to try to do that in certain ways that are like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So I wouldn't want to give young people, you know, PTSD because of my movies. But I would say that we also have to understand that the earth is traumatized right now. That the forests are dying, the oceans are dying, the planet is dying. It's experiencing trauma. And that we cannot heal our own trauma without healing the earth as well. This is a relationship. We're part of the earth. And so we have to focus on the ways in which we don't continue to traumatize the earth and each other, but we also have to focus on healing. So how do we do that? That's the big task right now. But I do think young people have to learn about it. And what I was trying to do in How to Let Go of the World was present an arc to that realization, which I don't think everybody got all the way through. I mean, I would highly suggest people watch it or watch it again. You can watch it for free right now at joshfoxfilm.com. So all my films are up for free. I'm putting it in the chat. joshfoxfilm.com. People can watch them all there. And I really recommend How to Let Go. But I recommend it after watching Gaslight Part 1 and Part 2, because you see the whole arc, the whole journey of that 6 years of my life. But I guess what I'm saying is, in that movie, I was trying to scare the bejesus out of people for the first half an hour. And then for the next hour, show the people who were working on it in an inspiring way. You know what I mean? So there's sort of two movies, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Change Is. There are two films that in the middle of the movie, the drone goes up into the air and I sort of disappear. The movie stops, I quit the movie, and then I start the movie over again. And the whole point of the starting of the movie over again is to make people feel better, because there's a lot, or make people feel like they can be active, because there's so many climate movies that make you crazy and upset. And they just leave it there. And I didn't want to do that. But I also didn't want to lie to people and say, oh, we can fix this so easily. You know what I mean? So I had to go through that moment of being completely terrified and being in grief and come out the other side. And I think for young people, or a lot of people actually got stuck in the first half. And then the second half, they were just like, I can't, so I think it's the whole arc of that film that was trying to take people through that emotion rather than suppress it, go through it, and then come out the other side into a place of action. That was my hope anyway. But I don't know. I mean, I think Jane hadn't seen the movie. Your teacher hadn't seen the movie. So I don't know if she saw it actually. She might've seen it. I'm not so sure if she saw it or not, if she knew if it was going to be age appropriate, but I think she was just like, these are New York kids. Let's just do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And people get, you know, people, you're, how old are you?
I'm 16 now.
Yeah, when I was 15, I was playing drums in CBGBs. I was, New York kids are awake and alive in the world in a completely other way. You know what I mean? Than I think kids who are, you know, perhaps a little bit more sheltered.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said about how, like, individuals feel the weight of climate change. And that was actually one of my questions, is how much do you think individuals bear the weight of climate change? Like, I know in my school, my liberal high school, a lot of kids are like, oh, plastic straws are bad, like we should switch to reusable straws in the building. But like, how much do you think individuals making changes in their lives helps?
Well, you know, that's a fantastic question. And I think everyone wants to do something as an individual. And we are in a very individualistic society, right? Our society puts us into these individual chambers all the time, where we are individually responsible for our own lives, for our own food, for our own money, you know. And in fact, that's a kind of bizarre way of doing human life, because it's very, very difficult compared to, like, if we were to act collectively, right? So let's just say this. There are about 100 companies that are responsible for climate change. And they're also, by the way, the same companies, I think, that are responsible for plastic. Now, those companies have very consciously tried to push responsibility onto you. They've tried to trick you into thinking it's your fault. So BP, British Petroleum, one of the most abusive and horrific companies on the face of the earth, that caused the huge BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, BP invented the idea of your carbon footprint. You've probably heard of your carbon footprint, right? What's my carbon footprint? So if you eat meat, you have a bigger carbon footprint than if you're a vegan, presumably, maybe not actually, depending on how you do it. If you fly on planes all the time, right? You have a bigger carbon footprint than if you walk places. If you drive a lot of places, you have a bigger carbon footprint than if you take your bicycle, right? However, so that's like, you're like, oh my God, I have to do my best. I have to take care of everything. I have to become a vegetarian. I have to ride my bicycle. I have to do plastic straws. I have to do all this stuff. Well, as it turns out, if you did all of that by yourself, alone, as an individual, you would do nothing to say, you would not solve the climate change problem. You would not, right? And, the companies themselves would stay in charge. Now, not only are those people the ones who have to change all of their practices, if all of those companies decided they weren't going to produce and use fossil fuels or plastics anymore, and they were going to monitor their carbon footprint, it would change. But they've successfully taken the responsibility off of them and put it onto you. Now, that's a massive deception. It not only doesn't solve the problem, but it traumatizes and makes you feel guilty and ashamed of who you are, right? That's a terrible thing to do to people. I want to say this really clear. The people who run those companies are criminals. They belong in jail. The heads of ExxonMobil, BP, these people are making huge, huge, huge amounts of money by destroying the earth. They know exactly what they're doing. They belong in jail for climate crimes. The fracking industry here in Pennsylvania was charged with felonies, criminal felonies for destroying the environment, for harming people. These people, ExxonMobil had their own scientists in the 70s investigate the effects of their product. They knew exactly what their product was going to do. It was going to create a carbon in the atmosphere of about 419 parts per million by this time, and it would create all the things that we're seeing right now. And instead of going, uh-oh, we're going to kill the planet, they ignored it and buried it and did exactly the opposite. They said, they went out there when real scientists came out and said, listen, you've got to stop this. Those scientists were attacked by ExxonMobil. So instead of adapting their business model to save the planet, they decided to make money off of basically the apocalypse. That's criminal. And continuing to do that is criminal. So what do? We have to form the way that the world changes. We have to take that on, right? If you imagine Martin Luther King saying to the world, you know, each and every one of you, well, how do I put this? If you were to take the responsibility for all of racism on as an individual, that wouldn't work. You'd have to change the laws. You'd have to change culture. You'd have to create a movement. And a movement is what we have now. We have a lot of incredible people involved in the climate movement. You have Fridays for Future. You have the Sunrise Movement. You have 350.org. You have the anti-fracking movement. You have an incredible array of ways to interact. And those movements have to come together, not only as on the environment, not only like anti-fracking and climate and so on, but we have to create connections with the racial justice movement, with the movement for LGBTQ rights, with the women's movement, with the anti-war movement. All of these social justice issues, we have to come together and bring that intersectional dialogue, which is why I love this idea of the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is not focused on like, let's just build solar panels and wind turbines and everything is fine, because that's not true. The idea behind the Green New Deal is justice, social justice. And solar panels and wind turbines and a huge transformation of our economy away from fossil fuels is a big part of that. But I always say, you know, spend, you know, 5% of your time changing your light bulb and 95% of your time changing your politician. So we can do the things like this plastic straw, or 5% of the time spending your, you know, changing your plastic straw, and 95% changing your politician. So your school is a great place to start. Organize at the local level. If you organize to write to, you know, Congress, to your senator, say, we don't want any fracking, or you write to the mayor, we need to be prepared for climate change. Look what happened in New York City yesterday with just this one little flood. All the subways were completely just taken out, you know, not all of them, but there were flash floods all over the city. We were absolutely not prepared for, and we're not prepared for climate change. We're absolutely not. So, you know, we have to do that on a local level, but the way we do it is we organize. When we organize, we win. We organize each other. That means you got to be really persuasive. So as an individual, you don't focus on like, oh, I need to do this me. I need to do this myself. No. What you do as an individual is you go out there and you lead. You go out there and you speak. You go out there and you inspire people. If you're that one person, right, in that screening, like I was that one person, you know, you don't say, oh, I'm going to never drive, blah, 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 blah. Like, I'm going to take this all. That won't work. You get up there in that cafeteria, you stand on that chair, and you go and you speak about it. You get your facts straight, and you figure out how to be compelling emotionally to people, and you go out there and you lead. You know what I mean? We need youth leaders. We need women youth leaders, right? We need that. So that's what changes. If you want to take an individual responsibility, you take that on as a leader. You take that on as a person who will inspire others and organize for others, right? Now, not everybody's going to be a good organizer, right? I'm the most disorganized person on the planet, you know? When I first heard about fracking, I'm really glad that I didn't walk up to them and go, I want to organize for you, you know? Because not only would I have done a bad job of it, I would have probably quit in 3 weeks because I don't even have, you know, I can't organize a sock drawer. But I went to them and I said, I can make movies. you know, and I can make you a movie, you know, and that, you know, 12 years later, I'm still making movies, right? Because I love that and I'm good at that. So you have to do what you love and you add it to the movement. So if you're that person who's a great speaker, if you're that person who does podcasts, if you're that person who does, you know, graphic design or art, do that. That's your responsibility to you, to what you love. What you love will help save the planet. But then you also have to do the other thing, which is to be the foot soldier, to be the thing that makes you not unique, to show up at the rally, to show up at the protest, to show up in the, at the times when we really need numbers. You know what I mean? So there's those two balancing acts. One is what you do, what you love, and give that to the struggle. And then also make sure you're doing the thing that maybe you don't love. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but really matters, like showing up at a rally or showing up at a protest or showing up to vote, you know, all those little, those things, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my answer. Don't let the BP make your trauma worse by saying, oh my God, you learned that the world is ending. Guess what? It's your fault. It's not your fault. You inherited this mess, but it is your responsibility to fight against it.
Yeah, that's funny. I wish we had had this conversation a day earlier because I went on a plane like a couple days ago and I was like, oh,
and you felt bad.
I was like, I'm going on a plane.
Yeah. Well, listen, sometimes we have to go on planes. Sometimes we have to drive. You know, the system has to change. And, you know, flying is a hard thing. It's for the environment, but it's not the problem. To be honest, flying is not the problem. The problem is cars everywhere. And the problem is the system. We have to change the system. We have to go to zero emissions. And we're on our way. And the only reason we're on our way, people got to.
I also wanted to go back to like what you said about art. So I love art myself and I love art and all that stuff. So how do you think art can impact the climate crisis and how can we use art to our advantage in a way?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at all the other social movements in history, it was always the music, the movies, the art that brought people to the thing, you know? Speaking itself is an art, I think, or oratory is an art. So, you know, when you have great speakers up there on the platforms to motivate people, that I think of that as an art form. But I do think, at least from my perspective, as a filmmaker, you have to take control of the narrative. You have to take control of the story, right? People, one of the things that makes people unique among all animals is that we tell stories. And when we tell good stories, people get emotionally invested. And so for me as a storyteller, this has always been the ambition, which is to take a story and have it capture people's imagination and have it go and change things. And luckily with Gasland, that was able to happen, right? We found a very compelling way to tell the story about fracking, and we redefined fracking. We defined fracking. The industry wanted to define it. They wanted to say, it's all wonderful, no problems, everything is fine. And we showed the world that that was a lie because we told a better story. So storytelling, you know, every piece of art has some kind of narrative, and it's also emotional, right? Statistics and facts, I think for too long, you know, the climate movement was focused on science only, right? You know, 350.org, the numbers of, you know, 2 degrees warming, all of this stuff was about science, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it frankly kind of left the people pretty dry, you know? And I think what we're seeing now with the storms, the wildfires, the you know, the things that are happening, the death of so many ecosystems because of climate change, the harm that it's doing to people, there's another level of storytelling that needs to happen. And I think people are telling a different story now. And it's a more compelling story. So we have to find the most compelling ways of telling those stories. So that's where I think art comes in, certainly in terms of film and narrative, but also visual art and music. You know, that is the emotional through line of a movement, of politics. And, you know, we have to not just be about the art, right? It can't just be about, hey, watch this movie and now you're cool, not because you know something. You know what I mean? It's got to be about like, no, what's the next step? The cat is really wanting my attention too. The next step is, if you watch, if you remember in How to Let Go, Sandy makes an appearance. Oh, Sandy. Sandy makes an appearance in the beginning when I'm dancing. She's just there right there. She's named after Hurricane Sandy. Yes. She always steals the show. There she is. That's right.
Yeah,
Sandy. Anyway, so, well, all my cats came out of the woods, so I don't know what kind of cats, but Sandy is very special. She's a lilac cat. It's very rare. She's purple and pink. Usually we call her the Pink Panther. So she has this very weird pink tinge to her, which is very rare, pink and purple, sometimes an orange in certain lights. So it's very, very rare, but she's called a lilac cat. We call her the Pink Panther. Anyway, she's going to get mad at me in a second because I'm not paying enough attention to her. But she always gets involved when I'm doing a podcast or something because she just knows. Somehow she knows. She's like, I'm going to make this better. She does. So anyway, telling a good story, telling a story with emotion, you know, if you could have kittens against climate change, you do a lot. You know what I mean? You have to draw people in emotionally. And I think art is capable of a level of complexity that science and journalism sometimes is not, because we're using the head and we're using the heart, right? We're using our emotions and we're using our intellect. And so I think that it's absolutely crucial. Now there's a lot of bad art about politics, and that's something that we have to acknowledge, right? If you can put it on a sign and walk it down the street, it's not art, it's politics, right? So we get a lot of preachy art because there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the relationship between art and politics, in my view. Like, art is about questions and politics is about answers. So a question, a journey, an investigation, right? Like, so for example, my film, Gasland, or How to Let Go of the World, they have questions embedded, right? So the question of how to let go of the world is, oh, well, you know, what do we do to solve climate change in the same way that we solve the fracking problem here? You know what I mean? And then lo and behold, the question gets answered a third of the way through the movie. Oh my God, you're not going to solve a lot of these problems. So I have to start with a new question. What do we do now? The minute a question in a movie gets answered, the movie's over. The movie's boring because the audience just wants to know what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next, right? So with Gasland, we never said like, oh, this is what you should do. We just said, is fracking bad? Is it good? Is fracking this? Is fracking that? You know what I mean? And when the credits would roll, that's when the activists would come into the room, the politics would come into the room, people like Jane, your teacher, people like, you know, politicians, people like organizers and activists would come and say, okay, the art gave you the question. Now here's the answer, right? So art makes you uncomfortable. It makes you unsettled. It makes you off balance, right? That's what it's supposed to do. If you answer the question in your art, people are going to be like, oh, well, the question is answered. So I feel fine now. Goodbye. You have to leave them in a place where they're really unsettled and they don't know what to do. You know, like Bertolt Brecht would never resolve his plays. He would leave them on the edge. And that's the way I do my films as well. We leave people on the edge where they don't know what to do next. And then the politics has to become involved, right? So I bet you, if you asked yourself at age 16, I'll ask you right now, what are two or three questions that you wake up with every morning that you've learned in your 16 years, like, or one question you wake up with every morning, what is a big, big question for you? And then if I asked you, okay, what's one thing you've learned? What's one answer that you have in your life? If you think about it for a second, what's one question that is always with you and what's one answer that's always with you?
Does it have to be like the answer to the question?
No, it can be totally separate. Like one question and one answer. One answer that helps you get through the day. One answer that helps you with your life. One question that bothers you all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question, like, it's kind of similar to the one you ask in your movie. I think I still haven't come to terms with the fact that there is never going to be a solution to climate change, and that like some of the stuff that's happened in the climate is irreversible, and like we're never going to be able to stop it fully.
So that's the question is, can you put it in the form of a question?
Yeah, like how do I come to terms with the fact that we're never going to be able to stop climate change?
Right. And what's the next?
You mean the answer? Like,
what answer do you have that you have arrived at in all of your years? What's one answer?
I think I'm still working on that answer, but maybe that at least I have.
Not the answer to the question, yeah. But just an answer.
Yeah. Answer in general is that I have my friends and my family.
Uh-huh. You have your friends and your family. You have a community, you have a support system.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So here's the very fundamental thing about art and politics, right? The art is unsettling you. The question is unsettling you. But the politics is always making you feel better. Politician's job is to go out there and make you feel better. They're like, oh my God, healthcare chaos. Medicare for all is the answer. Oh my God, the Iraq war. Pull out of Iraq is the answer, always the politics, right? The answers are designed to make you feel better. That's good, you know? So your answer is, I have a support system. How can we make that support system our government? How can we make that support system our communities? How can we make that support system bigger? That's a movement. A movement is a support system for the question that's bothering you. Now, there is some new science, which I want to tell you. Michael Mann, if you listen to my my show, Staying Home with Josh Fox, Michael Mann is coming on soon again. You can get the interview that I just did with him on WJFF. WJFF is a radio station up in the Catskills. If you look through their archive, you can find me and Michael Mann. It's the most recent one. It hasn't come out on the TV show yet. But if you look up Josh Fox, Michael Mann, WJFF, you can find the radio program where he's talking about this. And I have still yet to investigate this. But Michael Mann, back in 2015, when I interviewed him, he said, well, we have this much warming built in, and we have this much warming that we can go before the whole death of the planet. But what he said to me recently was something much more hopeful. He said, the recent science is saying that if we stop burning carbon emissions, then in fact, the heat levels off. And that it's not too late. So yes, there are huge impacts that are happening now. California wildfires, floods, the collapse of coral reefs. There will be we're going to negotiate one of the most difficult periods of change that humanity's ever negotiated. But it's not too late, is what he is saying and what the new science is saying. So this is something that we need to investigate. He wrote a book called The New Climate Denial, which I highly suggest you get it. It's called The New Climate War. And what it is, it's about how fossil fuel companies are pushing this doomism. That the idea that we're in a doomsday scenario, no matter what, because then people get depleted, they get depressed, they don't act. So Michael Mann is saying, wait a minute, we can't fall into that trap. And some of that was what I was trying to do with How to Let Go of the World, right? I was trying to face the facts and not fall into the pit of despair. So I would say, you know, maybe watch the film again, especially the second half, where all these people are saying, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep fighting. We're going to fight every single day. We can't just give up. And I would also check out this new book by Michael Mann, the scientist, who is the guy in How to Let Go, who is the darkest person in that movie. And read his new work about how it's called The New Climate War. It's a brilliant book. It's kind of like a how-to of exactly the problem that you're in. How do we avoid getting into a space of despair or being manipulated by the fossil fuel industry to such a degree that we can't function anymore, you know? So those are my pieces of advice. You know, your support system that you know you have, my family, my friends, there's a wider support system, and that is your community. And that is, and you choose your community, right? We don't always choose our family and our friends. For some people, their family is not a support system, right? For a lot of people, family is not a support system. Friends sometimes are also not a support system. But we have ways of human organization that we can choose. The movements can also be not a support system. But what I'm saying is that you have to be able to find a network of people that is going to give you hope and give you faith. And what I was trying to present in How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Climate can't change the fact that we make love songs. Climate can't change the fact that we have optimism and fighting spirit. Climate can't change all those things that I talk about in the film: courage, innovation, creativity, civil disobedience, the moral imagination. Climate change can't change those things. They can. So we have to grasp onto those values and say, we're going to move forward. So that was and maybe for, you know, when you watched it, when you're 10 years old, those are bigger concepts than the terror that's involved in what you're getting. But I would say rewatch the film, you know, and get something from the second half of it. And it's you can watch it for free right now at joshfoxfilm.com. But we put up all my films for free during COVID just because we wanted people to feel like they had some free stuff because everyone was stuck at home. The idea, though, that like, you know, we're not in a complete doom, but it is something. It's not your individual response. It's your individual responsibility to take care of your psyche. It's nobody else's responsibility to do that. So you have to do those things to heal yourself, to get you motivated, and to get yourself to a positive space where you can function and you can act, right? You're doing this podcast, right? You're in a positive space. You're saying, I'm 16 years old, and I'm going to call Josh Fox and get him on my podcast. You know, that takes guts, right? You're going to do that. So great. Good on you. You're right there. Now do the next level. Like, figure out, you know, how to affect more people, how to bring your support system, which is your answer, and make that bigger. Don't treat them like your family, because that could be dangerous. You know what I mean? Don't treat them like you would your dad, your brother, your sister, because that's a very complex psychological relationship. Be clear with people, but there are communities there where we start to work it out and we start to bond. Sunrise Movement, Fridays for Future, 350, these organizations, the anti-fracking organizations, where you will find the best friends you've ever had in your life because you're working alongside of them on changing the world, you know? So that's a deep bond for people. So I would suggest, you know what I mean? Like, take a look at Michael Mann's new stuff, which was very, very hopeful to me. And don't try to do this alone, you know?
Yeah, I guess since you mentioned it, I will quickly plug Sunrise Movement because I love Sunrise Movement, especially the Sunrise Youth Hub of NYC. I've been working with them this past year and it's been really cool. They're really cool people, like you were saying.
So you know.
Yeah.
But that's the answer. I mean, it's not, I'm not going to lie to you. It's not easy. It's a tremendous burden. So you have to take care of yourself. That is your individual responsibility.
Yeah. Going back to kind of like earlier, How to Let Go, if you were to film another movie and you were to gear it specifically towards children, like learning about climate change, what do you think you would do?
Wow. I'm not sure I would do anything that different. I mean, obviously it affected you. I mean, I'm not so sure that I would do anything all that different. I really have to think about that. I mean, what age of children?
Like 10 or 11, same age I was.
Well, I think, I just don't know the answer to that question. I really have to think about that. I've never made a movie for children. Maybe it's a good thing to try. My friend Eve Ensler, who's now named V, because she rejects the name of her father gave her. V was working on a climate story about were revolting against the parents and the animals took their side. It was a big animated movie, which I think is a great idea. I did make a movie. I have made a treatment about a family who have an 8-year-old or 10-year-old daughter who stops speaking. And she stops speaking for a specific reason that I'm not going to give away yet on this program. But she begins communicating with an octopus who comes through her bathroom drain. And I really want to make this movie. And so far, no, I've pitched it a few places, but no one has given me the money to do it. But that movie is, a lot of it's for adults. But the central character is this 10-year-old girl. And I would love to see that get made. And now that I'm thinking about it, it would probably be a good movie for people in that age or just a little bit older, you know. My sister was obsessed with the movie Splash when she was about 10 years old. Maybe we should go back and check out Splash to look at it. But the idea that I really want to make this film, and I've written up a whole story about it. So I think I would focus on story, and I think I would focus on the kids, you know? I mean, like when I make movies for adults, I'm focusing on adults. When I'm making movies, when I wanted to talk about fracking to these people in Pennsylvania and in New York, I focused on the same kinds of people in Wyoming and Colorado and Texas that have been fracked to bring them into a sense of communication with each other, right? So if I were kids, we're kids. You know what I mean? If you can't see it, you can't be it, which is why it's so important that we have representation in our media of LGBTQ people, of Black people of color. If you can't see it, you can't be it, right? That's the rule. So if you can't see a kid in a movie being a climate activist, then it's hard for you to feel the sense of what I can do. You know what I mean? That's why stories are so important, right? Stories are so important because stories tell us who we are. And so if I was going to make a movie about climate change for kids, I think I'd put a lot of kids in it. And probably cats too, right, Sandy?
I would put dogs.
You would put dogs in it. You're a dog person. I was a dog person too until these cats came out of the woods, and I had to keep them because they were so wonderful. No, don't you drink my water? That's your water over there. You drink this water. Here, you take that one.
Yeah.
She's drink. This is the cutest thing you've ever seen. Go ahead, Sandy. Drink. No, she doesn't want it anymore. Cats are fickle.
Yeah. And if you were to also continue or even make a new movie that's similar to How to Let Go of the World, how has that movie changed since 2016 when it was filmed?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That movie was only one kind of product from that footage. So what I'm going to be doing, and maybe you want to be a part of this, is I'm going to be taking that film and expanding it into like a 12-hour miniseries, because there's so much more in that movie than what I showed. And we're going to do it called Climate Revolution or How to Let Go of the World, Lovable Things Climate Change. So it'll be the same basic arc, but 12 hours long, because there's so many more things. It's like episodic, like TV. There's so much more in it. So I'm going to be doing that over, we're going to do it on a kind of Patreon for subscribers to help us raise money, but we're going to be pushing that arc further and further and further and further out. So that's one thing that I really want to do. And I want to revise it with new information, like you're saying, from some of these new interviews. I think, you know, I'm moving in a direction of wanting to do more narrative work. I'm making a couple documentaries right now. I'm making a documentary about Rebecca Jones, who is the COVID whistleblower who blew the whistle against Ron DeSantis in Florida, saying they were falsifying COVID data so they could reopen the economy, which resulted in 50,000 people dying. She's amazing. So I'm making that. I'm making a film about plastic in the ocean and how plastic is an extremely terrible problem right now on the planet Earth. And I am interested in seeing how we can continue to make work on fracking. Because I don't think that story is done yet. It still continues. I would focus a little bit on the false solutions to climate change, right? Like their carbon capture, which looks really like a terrible thing. You know, this is a lifelong fight to watch the fossil fuel industry get dismantled. I would like to see that whole industry dismantled. I would like to see us move on to a totally different way of, on the planet. If we don't move on, we're in trouble. We know that. So we have to act quickly. But right now, I think, you know, you have to do what's inside of you to do. You can't force yourself to do something because, you know, it won't work. You know, I was making Gaslight, it was the most important thing in my life. Right now, I want to make this movie about this 10-year-old girl. And I need to figure out how to do that. I need to figure out how to get the money for it and how to push it forward, you know? That's really important to me. So it's you know, if I had unlimited resources, I would be doing that movie tomorrow. You know, I don't, I still have to go out there and try to figure out how to make it happen. So I think I would make the movie that I just told you about. That's the most important climate movie that I could make right now. And it would be, I think it would be really popular for younger people.
Yeah. And how do you think, you know, in the 4 years since that movie, the Trump administration has impacted your views on climate change? And has it made you, in a way, like, less hopeful? Because I know that's kind of what it did for me.
Well, the Trump years were really, really, really hard. And I'm so glad we're out of them. The Biden years are not great either. You know, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter because the person who was, you know, against fracking and for all the, you know, for all the things that Bernie Sanders stood for, Biden's still very much an establishment politician, pro fracking, you know, doing a lot of things that are not, I mean, he must be working much more diligently on the climate. And we all have to push that hard. There's a lot of good things he's doing, but it's not up to the task yet. It needs to be much, much more accelerated. The Green New Deal needs to be a huge, huge government program of $15-16 trillion. And now what they've got is $500 billion for climate. It's nowhere near enough. It's a good start. But what the Trump administration really did for me was recognize how scary the forces of genocide and racism can be. You know, my parents, well, my father, not my mother. My father was a Holocaust survivor. He was born right at the end of World War II in Europe, fleeing the Nazis. And all of his family was killed, except for his mother and father and two brothers, but all the extended family murdered by the Nazis. And the Trump administration made me really terrified at the forces of authoritarianism and the forces of racism in the world. We narrowly avoided having a truly authoritarian president, and that there are about 30 to 40% of the population of any country who just don't really want democracy. They don't want democracy, they don't want freedom. They want a strong authoritarian leader. And they don't care that that person is racist. They don't care that that person is sexist. They don't care that that person is violent. They don't care that that person is saying things that are not true all the time. That's a very scary force within humanity that can never take control of the government. So in terms of what I thought about Trump administration was, it really, I think, made people understand that there is no climate action without action on racial justice, without action on economic justice. These things are together. Because if we don't fight the forces of fascism and authoritarianism, we cannot fight climate change. And it was the fossil fuel industry that loved having Trump in office, right? Yeah. Trump literally made Rex Tillerson, the head of ExxonMobil, Secretary of State. I mean, and then when that didn't work out, Mike Pompeo, who was another oil and gas executive, they were literally running the State Department, running the government, running America's foreign policy.
Yeah.
So, you know, really bad. you can't get worse than that. So, you know, there's like, it's great that we got rid of Donald Trump, but the centrists, we've been wasting so much time. Obama wasted so much time on the environment, on climate change. Obama could have changed this whole scenario. Instead, he backed fracking. He did not accelerate a Green New Deal. He took very, very weak measures on stopping climate change. This, you know, is a huge, huge tragedy and a huge mistake. That because the Democrats were so weak, they lost 1,000 seats in state legislatures and Congress during Obama's term because they continued to not speak the language of the people. So I believe that if Bernie Sanders had been the nominee in 2016, not only would he have beaten Trump, but we'd be living in a very, very different country in a very, very different world right now. Instead, we have the rise of fascism and authoritarianism all over the world. Why? Because the centrists, Obama, decided Hillary Clinton was the appointed successor. And lo and behold, nobody liked Hillary Clinton. And she was a corporatist at the wrong moment. The Obama administration and the centrists put us in the place of having a Donald Trump because they did not meet the people's needs. You know, now we have a similar problem. Joe Biden is also a centrist and he's also not meeting the people's needs. He did not give us assistance during COVID, not to the degree we needed it, right? So that people could stay home. He did not provide cancellation of student debt, which is crippling a huge generation of Americans, right? He has not pushed Medicare for all. Medical debt in this country is astronomical and harming people. And business are not up to the challenge. So we have to push and push and push and push. Because they're so weak, they're losing elections. We have to make them stronger. So although I'm extremely grateful that Biden won, it was the progressives who were really the adults in the room. The progressives said, all right, we're going to go out there and do it, even though we don't like this guy, because we have to get rid of Trump. So what did Trump show me? It showed me that there's a real threat of the world ending because of a Donald Trump, right? Because of racism, because of authoritarianism, because of people like, you know, Hitler and Mussolini was genocides of people. An authoritarian government like Trump could end the whole world because of the climate, right? So we have to do that. But we can't be weak in our opposition to these people. We can't be like mealy-mouthed about it. We can't be milquetoast centrists. We have to be able to say, this is what the people want. This is what the people need. This is how our government's out of sync. And this is what the science and nature demands on the climate. Then you have to take those policies. You can't just say, well, how do I appease the oil industry at the same time as I work on the climate? That's not going to work. So I hope we can step in and start pushing on that more and more and more. But that is what Sunrise is doing. I believe that's what a lot of these movement groups are doing. We just need to strengthen those movements and we need to come together. How does Biden not address police issues in the United States after the summer that we had last year? Has not done it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is something that we have to deal with, because it seems like throughout our entire lives, right? Certainly yours, it's either been the centrists or the fascists. We don't have a true option for the people. That was what Bernie's revolution and the revolution I took place in meant. So we've got to hope that there's a way forward there.
Really quickly, I would assume from what you've been saying that you are in favor of ending the filibuster.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the filibuster has got a long, long racist history. Not only would I be in favor of ending the filibuster, the Senate is the most corrosive body in the United States right now. And why? Because there's 34 states that have the same amount of population, I think, as California or something, right? California should be broken up into six states. California should get 12 senators, okay? DC has to be a state. That's, you know, and we should probably take North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana and make them one state. That would truly represent the United States. It is the Senate that is destroying America. And not just because it was designed to do so. It was designed to protect slavery. It was designed to protect a rural agrarian minority who were, you know, definitely racist. It was designed to protect the South. That can't continue. We have to have fundamental restructuring of the way that works. So yes, start with the filibuster, get rid of the filibuster. But also, if the Senate reflected to a degree, you know, like the United States has always broken up big states and made them smaller states, you know, Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky and Tennessee, like, you know, we need to break up California into six states. We need to break up Texas probably as well. And we need to break up Florida. These states have outsized power. And right now, what does it mean? Or undersized power in terms of the Senate, right? So what does it mean? It means that the will of the people is being completely hijacked by a small white supremacist, Christian, conservative minority, keeping this country back, and not just this country, the world. So just end the filibuster, but also say we need 12 senators from California. Now, two of them would probably be Republicans, right? But not the majority of them. So the problem is built into the structure, gerrymandering and the Senate. So, you know, we are in a place of basically tyranny because of those small states. I think you can look it up. It's like, you know, Los Angeles County, just Los Angeles alone, would I think be the third biggest state in the United States in terms of population. I'm looking this up for you.
While you're doing that, I also have another thing that, like, I think is super important to this conversation around, like, climate change and also being scared by climate change is, how do we get people prepared for these harsh realities? You know, I think a large part of the resistance we're seeing to critical race theory right now is people wanting, you know, to say like that isn't America and not wanting to have to face this reality. And I think that's similar to climate change deniers, right? Like, it's difficult to face this reality of climate change and having to, you know, entirely restructure our world.
So well, they're related.
Yeah, right. So how do we get people ready to hear those harsh truths?
Well, I don't think it's that people are not ready. Honestly, I think it's that, you know, the Republican Party is a racist white supremacist party. And they're controlling the country because of this problem that we just talked about, right? There is a population to senator imbalance that is out of control. You know what I mean? There's like a, like there is a, the system is not working. There's an opinion piece in New York Times. It came out 2 days ago. It's called America Needs to Break Up Its Biggest States. It's a really important one. And it talks about the history of how we broke up states, right? So the four largest states by population now make up roughly one third of the population of the entire United States, more than the smallest 34 put together. This poses a critical problem for Democratic legitimacy, primarily because of the Senate. Those four largest states have only 8 senators, while the 34 smallest states have a supermajority of 68 senators. So what's happening is you have a real imbalance that the Senate is out of touch, but that allows the Republicans to wield so much power when they have the minority of people supporting them. Same thing is true of the Electoral College, by the way, right? The Electoral College is another disaster and another remnant from times of slavery to protect slave owning states in the South. So we have a history and a legacy of racism that's holding back action on climate and also holding back action on racism, okay? So it's important to understand that America's fund, the structure of the American government is there to protect an institution of slavery. And it is now there to protect white supremacists. So defeating that structure, we have done a great job in the United States of defeating our own racism, right? I wouldn't say our own racism, the racism of the United States. We've done a terrific job of changing minds in the majority of the population to not be racist, to not be homophobic. The structure of the government is keeping it in place. So the structure of the of power in the United States is keeping it in place. That's why we don't have police reform. That's why we don't have Medicare for all. That's why we don't have gun control. That's why we don't have climate action. And so we have to take that on. We have to figure that out. We have to have a deeper level of representation. So to me, it's not about like, you know, Martin Luther King never went to the KKK, I don't think, and spent a lot of time trying to convince them not to be racists. There were certain people that were just not going to change. What you do is you get the power. And the power in a democracy is supposed to come from the majority of the people, right? We're supposed to have them. We have the majority of the people. Why don't we have the power? So we have to focus on how do we make sure we get the power, because we do have the majority. That means we get people involved. Get people involved. A lot of people involved, right? By doing podcasts, by speaking out, by being adamant about those things. So it's, to me, it's like, again, when we organize, we win. And so, you know, I think you're asking all the right questions. But again, don't forget that just as the carbon footprint of you is your little tiny carbon footprint, don't go to the BP calculator. I'm going to calculate my carbon footprint. No, go to BP and say, well, what's your carbon footprint? Don't say, how do I make it better that racists, you know, change, you know? No, you simply say, we're going to create laws to outlaw racism. We're going to outlaw all the manifestations of racism. We have some of those laws, anti-discrimination laws. They can go much further. But in order to do this, we have to stop this completely hostile takeover by the minority who are overtly racists. And they are overtly working for the fossil fuel industry, right? I mean, and those things are together. You know, fossil fuels and racism are tied at their history. So, you know, that's a big job. But I think it's less about like, how do I talk to the, how do I waste my time like talking to one racist on Instagram or at my school, as opposed to, we take over our school and we change the laws. We take over our city and we change the laws, because we're in the majority. And the power always comes from the people. It has to. So if enough people rise up to change these things, I believe they will change. It takes time, but more than time, it takes organizing, you know? Yeah. So I would let go of a little bit. Like, you're not gonna convince BP to stop selling gasoline. You just take away their power. You're not going to convince Mark Zuckerberg to stop doing data collection. You just break up Facebook into a million pieces, like take away their power. That's what I'm focused. That's what I like to focus on. I mean, I think it's about those power struggles. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I do want to be mindful of your time because we're already 10 minutes.
Yeah, no, I do have to go, but it's been delightful to talk to you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
So after listening and talking to Josh Fox, I did go back and rewatch How to Let Go. And I think that what Josh Fox really gets right is in remembering that power to the people can only happen by telling the stories of people. And the reason why Josh Fox's documentary struck me where so many others didn't is because it's a film really about the people and about people who find hope in times of crisis, and they don't do that by ignoring the reality of climate change. They do that by accepting and doing something about it. And I think the only way we can truly find hope in this time is by understanding that some things we just can't change, but others we can and should. And I think that that is what's truly hopeful about How to Let Go.